Welcome to our next installment of the Strategic Finance Studio, brought to you in collaboration with the American Council on Education. I'm Rick Stasloff, founder and senior partner with RPK Group, and I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, Maria Anguiano. Maria, welcome. So let's jump in into our main topic. We've been calling this Beyond a Bailout. You and I have talked for the better part of a decade now, Maria, that, you know, we've lived in higher ed more on what I'd call the revenue side of the equation, right? You know, what's driving in through increasing pricing? How do we get more support from public funding, state, local, federal? How do we drive more philanthropy? Important, it'll always be important. What we haven't done is figured out the expense side of the equation. Why? Does providing high quality education cost what it costs? And in the current COVID environment, of course, the biggest calls are for more federal support, more federal bailouts. So when you think about that, is that the right solution? I mean, should we just keep adding commas and zeros to what we want our public sources to be providing to higher ed in the current moment?
I think the short term is very different than the long term, in my view, right? I always think about Maslow's needs, and when your house is on fire, it's really hard to be thinking about your five-year plan. And so until we get our campuses and our universities and colleges in a stable footing where they feel stable, it's just going to be hard to envision, have a future-focused conversation, envision what a future might look like. So I think the bailouts are really important from a stabilization standpoint.
Is it possible, though, for institutions to be responding in the short term, you know, to make sure that the house is on fire, we got to stabilize things, but to do that in a way that sets us up at least for a longer term look towards sustainability? Can we do both?
I think so. I think part of, in some ways, you just can't, right? There's some just immediate expenses related to testing, expenses related to lost revenue, where you just really, again, need to throw water into that fire and move on. I do think there's like a subset of things that maybe will accumulate over the next, or are accumulating now and will accumulate over the next 6 months, which is the lessons learned, right? So again, as an example, one of the questions asked at our last UC Regent meeting was like, do we need to build any more 900 person lecture halls? You know, big lecture halls cost $100 million. Now that we know how to do, we have this capacity that we've learned how to do remote learning, it's like, well, do we need these 900 person classrooms? Because they're really just is there any different as a recording as it is sitting in the classroom in the 50th row trying to figure out whether you can see the professor, right? Like there's some pedagogy that you're like, well, that doesn't make sense anymore with this new environment. So I think the opportunities I see is innovation in delivery of courses and pedagogy and things that professors are learning as they're experimenting. Again, I don't think this is necessarily the answer, like, oh, just going to, well, you know, Zoom University as the answer to pedagogy. But I think what it does do is open up a lot of ideas of what could be the case when you were forced to try something different that maybe hadn't been in your head. And then once you try that thing different, you might be like, hey, that's not necessarily the right answer, but this now gives me 10 other ideas of what I could do, right? And I think that's where what we are doing now could be prep for getting ready for the future.
So we're putting the right questions on the table. Is there also an element, do you see, of acceleration? That is, some of this stuff we've been doing some of, or we've been talking about doing, now we're actually doing it and we're moving it forward more quickly. And some of it may not work, but we'll learn along the way.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key to me is the, are we learning from this? Or if you're thinking about, I just want to revert back to what I was currently, you know, what I was doing before, I think that's where I get your point about how bailout could just allow folks to just go back to exactly what they were doing. But I don't think that's the case. I think universities by nature, you know, have a lot of folks that love to learn, right? Professors, students, everyone there. And I'm just hearing it a lot more, both at ASU and throughout the UC system, like all the new ideas that professors have come up with, or all of a sudden being like, oh, I didn't realize I could teach music via synchronous remote learning. And right. So I just think that the capabilities that we'll be able to have will be able to accelerate quicker as I think both individual professors, departments, schools start to learn a lot of lessons from what they had to experience. And the winners here will be the ones that take those lessons and figure out what to do in the future and not just revert back to what they always did.
I love that. So let's say I'm a president, I'm in the C-suite somewhere, and I want to be a winner, right? I want to learn. I don't want to say, glad that COVID thing's done, right? Let's go back to doing what we were doing the way we're doing it. How are you thinking, or what would you tell me in my leadership role about how to keep that dialogue going?
That's a tough question. How do you do that effectively? I think what worked well for at least some of the work I did when I used to work at UC Riverside and was trying to move some operational effectiveness initiatives forward, we would just have big town halls where 300 people would show up to these massive areas that we would set up, and they'd all be in little tables, and we have a lot of questions set up for them, and folks would participate in brainstorming on different topics of how we might be more effective, you know, in this area or in that area. And what would happen is, and then we'd even have them working on, you know, like the clickers so they could answer questions, etc. And so everyone would visually see all the feedback, and it was really exciting for people to participate in designing the future, and seeing their own feedback reflected right up on the screen or up in the readouts. And so it created a lot of campus cohesion, and surfaced just a ton of ideas that had been laying dormant out in the campus. So I would think that something similar to that in the both on the operational side and on the academic pedagogy side would be an important initiative for different college presidents to take on.
So communication, probably over communication, right? In the current environment, what are we learning? What are we seeing? What's really messed up that we haven't dealt with yet?
Right. But setting up the right type of communication to me is really critical, right? And sometimes people think communication means one directional. Oh, if, you know, the C-suite just sends a bunch of messages to campuses. And that's not the type of communication I'm talking about. I'm talking about how do you engage people at scale to hear the ideas reflected back at you, and really co-develop rather than just communicating kind of on a one-way basis.
You know, you talked about Riverside, and I know how deep you and the team went there, which makes me think about communication, yes, but also data. You know, how do we know what's working? How do we even define what working means? How do you bring that together so that we've got the quantitative side combined with what we're sharing, even qualitatively, to figure out of all the things we might do, we better do that one next.
Another initiative we had was helping us understand cost structure. And for that, we created a model that basically allowed us to see both the revenue and expense side of different courses, basically for every course on campus. And that was important as we thought about planning what to do going forward. You know, it's funny that you mentioned there's the revenue side and the expense side, and I really don't see those two as separate. I see them as combined because by themselves, they really mean nothing, right? So if somebody asks you, is $20,000 a good price for a car? Well, I don't know. Is it a junker or is it a Tesla? I might decide differently based on, and so to have just like the expense number by itself, like really doesn't mean anything. Same thing on the revenue side. If you say I have $100,000, is that going to be enough to cover my expenses? Well, again, I don't know what your expenses are, so how could I possibly know, right? So it's really only when you combine the revenue and expense numbers together that you start and break that down into deeper levels, whether it's how much it costs to run a major, how much it costs to run a course, that you can really start getting insights about what that might mean for the operations going forward. But just how you wouldn't make a decision on a car just based on the number itself, you wouldn't make a decision on a course based on just the numbers, right? It's what are the outcomes that are coming out of that course. How does it relate to perhaps your strategy? So one of the findings we had at Riverside was that our computer science courses were actually pretty effective in teaching computer science and were financially sustainable. And this is a unit where had we just looked at the top line data, it would have looked like it was really expensive and we couldn't afford to grow that department. But by looking at the granular data, we were able to realize that on a per student basis, it actually was financially sustainable to grow. And so that's a high need area in the world, something students were really interested in, something we had an interest in growing, and yet we weren't doing it because we didn't have the right data. So I think by having that right data, be able to make better decisions.
Great example, to me of, it's a good story, right? That you get those aha moments and you get them at the right level. So how did that happen? Just to build on that story. So you had this data, you had this aha moment around, wow, we could actually grow this. Did people get on board once you were able to share that back?
Yeah, if you share it, sometimes I think just numbers by themselves are just, again, hard to digest. So a lot of what we try to do either now here at ASU or in my old jobs is really visualize the data. Visuals for people are just much more impactful. And so on that particular front, it was easy to get folks on board. I think what was difficult there was being able to train everyone to how to actually use this data effectively for themselves, right? So if I had insights, it was easy to communicate them. But I think the hard part and the part maybe I haven't figured out yet is how do you get a massive group of people to take that same data and have those same insights themselves and then do something about it? It's coming from everywhere in the organization, department chairs, deans, and not just, the provost or the CFO.
So how do we then stretch forward? We're talking about communication. We're talking about data in the current environment. What else do you think about on the expense side of the equation and your good point around really getting to net revenue, right? Really getting to margin. I mean, we don't always like to use those words. Do you think as an industry, we're going to start getting over some of that resistance, that knee-jerk reaction that higher ed's not a business? Well, it's not a for-profit business, but it needs to have some business elements to really be healthy going forward.
Yeah, I like to think about it as an enterprise, right? Because enterprise is really a more neutral word. Business, by definition, is for profit. And so I get why folks react poorly to, it's like a business. Well, no, it's an enterprise, and enterprises need to be financially sustainable, no matter what the motive is. And so if you look at it that way, I think folks, especially with this period that where they are struggling about how to get to financial sustainability, are going to have to just get more comfortable in going through the numbers and saying what's our net revenue, what's that going to look like going forward, and how do we create financially sustainable futures going forward. I think I'm not sure if it's all about the expense side. I would say in education, it's especially with digital things, it seems a lot to be about really looking at the marginal costs, marginal revenues, right, and how those stack up. Because ultimately, a lot of campuses have just a massive amount of fixed expenses by definition. They're big campuses, have big, massive infrastructure, and so that's a fixed cost. And in any industry where you have a massive fixed cost, the question is, how are you able to produce as much as you can with that fixed, with some of those fixed costs? And then that, I think, is how you don't think about necessarily the expense side and how to cut things, but actually how to better utilize your assets. So like I use that example on the classroom, because I think that's such a interesting one, where it's like, do I spend $100 million building a 300 and 500 person lecture hall, Or do I use that instead to actually invest in technology that will allow me to reach more learners, right? And on a marginal basis, that net revenue is just going to be higher in that view than if you're reinvesting into fixed assets. And so I think, I guess I think about it in that way, is what are you investing in from a expense side? So it's almost not expenses, it's investments, to allow you to be able to serve more students.
Yeah, there's an element where creating bigger classrooms is really helping us maybe in an even more tangible way around some of the equity concerns we have, right? In terms of access, affordability, making sure that people have a seat at the table.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the digital world is that it's very different from the analog world, right? And again, I'm just speaking about large public universities here, not about small of arts colleges, but you know, you think about Amazon or Google or some of the really big technology companies, and it's like the bigger you are, the better your product is, because you have more money to invest in that product, right? And that's a very different world than when you think something smaller is better because it's more artisanal, etc. In a digital world, the more money you have to invest into your infrastructure, the better your products actually are. And so in education, I think the mindset shift is going to be, if you have $2 million to invest in the best biology course, that's way better than having $100,000 to invest in that biology course. And in order to have the $2 million, you need scale. And so I think we'll see a shift to how do universities collaborate together to be able to invest for a more scaled approach to investment instead of this more unique artisanal.
I love this because it takes us towards that path of reinvestment, which takes us back to return on investment, right? That it's not just cost savings, who really cares, right? It's really not just margin, it's how do we generate resources to reinvest in mission and in student success, which really is a culture shift, I think, in a lot of ways. You said it, it's a whole different way to think about the academic enterprise.
It is a mindset shift, and it just comes from years of doing things all in analog, which has very different dynamics than a digital world, right? And it's almost like helping people understand the dynamics in the digital world actually will lead to a lot of innovation, because it's different economics, different behaviors, different everything in these different worlds, and you start to integrate them together, and then that leads to a whole other set of like super interesting ways to learn, right?
So do you think that opportunities is there though for those small private liberal arts? Like a lot of people would say, oh, fine, Maria, you're at ASU, or if I were talking to Paul at Southern New Hampshire, right? It'd be like, yeah, you can do that. I can't do that. Do you think that's true? Can we apply that kind of thinking at lots of different levels across sectors of higher ed?
I mean, there's big, massive universities that are still not doing this. Take UC, for example. UC has 200,000 students across 10 campuses. It definitely has a scale, but it's still not doing it, right? It's still not thinking about how do we invest together as a system to be able to create a higher capacity. So I think that's something that folks are realizing now and thinking about how do we actually do this. And so I would say that's the same at, you know, the small liberal arts colleges, whether they have consortiums or creating the University Innovation Alliance, things that allow colleges, universities to collaborate together to create learning resources together that'll help them both create the best learning resources there are and reduce their per unit cost for themselves, right? Because they're co-investing with others.
It does seem to be a good opportunity. Still a struggle though. I was talking to an institution just the other day and said, let's look at the map. There are a dozen or more institutions within a mile around you. You know, we could pull backroom operations together. Who cares who cuts your paycheck, or healthcare, all sorts of things. And boy, they got stuck in, yeah, but our people are healthier than their people. And we cut paychecks differently than other people cut paychecks. It was tough, you know, just to sort of start to think about how do we at least do the back room differently?
But that's, I think that's, again, going back to the what's going to help people thrive in this environment versus not, getting over those things, right? And saying, let's collaborate on our back end system. So the Claremont colleges are five different, very unique liberal arts colleges, and then there's the Claremont Graduate College, so six in total. And again, like I said, they're all very unique, all with their very own curriculum, faculty. Claremont, you know, is very focused on economics, government, political science. You have Harvey Mudd, which is one of the best, basically, engineering schools in the country. And there's Pomona, Scripps, Pitzer. But they all share all sorts of resources, it's back-end resources. I'm thinking about how to collectively run payroll, et cetera. But also, I mean, as a student, I was able to take courses at any of the five colleges, right? So that I was a Spanish major and I could take courses at Pomona and at Scripps that were never going to be offered at Claremont. And so here's a way to create a lot more diversity of courses for your students to take advantage of without having to create those resources yourself. And still all be in, you know, top colleges. And so I think that model's a great one that others could learn from.
And they have that separate entity. It's even a separate legal entity, right? The Claremont College Services run facilities, library, security, all the back room stuff. And then the other colleges actually buy services from that entity. Isn't that how it works?
Yeah, that's right. And like they have a joint library, right? Which again, have a lot more robust of a library if you're sharing it with five other colleges. So I would encourage folks to look at that model.
Yeah, they do admittedly have the advantage geographically, right? They're all pretty close together, as I recall.
Yeah, well, they're all basic, I mean, literally across the street from each other.
Exactly. Regardless, the idea that particularly in this day and age, we could be working together to lower the cost of those services, which saves us money, which lets us reinvest in the things that we want to do to drive student success, to drive mission, et cetera. So it kind of really reinvents, I think, the emphasis you talked about earlier of driving towards margin and net revenue for reinvestment. Yeah, how do we get more for our systems? You know, SUNY's long pushed this idea of systemness, right? We are a system, but do we really get the full benefit of it? And what would that look like? And it certainly seems to be potentially a really good hope coming out of this that it could, again, is it a new idea? No. Have we acted on it fully? No. Could this be an opportunity out of urgency to push harder in that direction?
And I think there's also, for even for the ones that aren't systems, or aren't in the same state or geographically located, so you have the University Innovation Alliance that has 11 universities across the nation that are collaborating. And they can't collaborate on everything, but they've picked several things to look at that is consistent across all of them. So how do you do predictive analytics better, right? And by sharing best practices amongst each other, they're able to improve retention, student success, and that's across states, across different population types. So I think there's definitely things that folks would collaborate on, whether or not they're part of a same system or geographically together.
What's your biggest hope coming out of the current crisis for higher ed?
I guess my biggest hope is that we take the current situation to really reimagine and envision a new future. And we don't just go back to the world as it was, but think about how do we provide a lot more access, more affordably to all the learners out there that need it, right? Right now we have not just the current population, you know, folks always talk about enrollment declines at the 18-year-old level, but there's millions, tens of millions of Americans, let alone the whole world, that need access to more education. And so what has this taught us in terms of our capabilities to be able to provide those learning offerings to folks here, either in the U.S. or around the world?
That's a pretty big one. I think that qualifies. And that's what, you know, I guess a little bit of where we started our conversation, you know, when we talk only about bailouts, I worry a little bit that we're not thinking about the reinvention, that we're thinking about how do we prop up a model that most of us have said isn't going to work long term anyway. And so does that mean that those kind of supports are bad? No. You know, in the short term, they help us get through. But making sure we keep our eyes on the future and the fact that not only do we need a new model for all those millions of Americans that need access to higher ed, but that we can go get a new model, right? It's within our grasp. We've got to just have that willingness and the culture change to be able to push towards it.
Yeah, and I think students are going to demand it with a lot more urgency than perhaps was, you know, 5 months ago. I would have had a different opinion about that.
Well, that's an important point, right? You know, I'm focusing on, will we deliver it? If our students say, that's not what I want anymore, I want this over here, and I'm going to go there and get it, that will help drive some of the conversation in and of itself. Sort of like I think about remote work coming out of the current environment, right? People are waking up to the idea that remote work works, and it works for the environment, it works for employees, it works for employers. If you're an employer that doesn't offer that, you may well have employees that say, sorry, I'm going to go over there because that employer will. So Maria, you know, it seems like everybody's talking, right? But there seems to be an even greater hunger within that talking around what's working, right? What could I put to use now in the current response to COVID-19 that might actually help me longer term towards this idea of stronger, more sustainable institutions? So, you know, if you had a few seconds to share with our listeners something that's really working to support your leadership team to drive change, what would you point to?
So I think it may sound minor, but it's been super effective at ASU, and that's having an executive meeting every day focused one on what we're calling defense and one focused on offense, which is that gives the leadership team an opportunity in our defense meeting to talk about the really urgent, important issues related to COVID today, right? So testing protocols, reopening the campus, things that are urgent on like that day. However, by having the offense meeting, so it's basically the cue that they're supposed to be thinking longer term. And so in that meeting, it's kind of our long-term meeting. What are we thinking about what this means in terms of future capabilities that this will, that what we're learning now will apply to ASU going forward? And so that gives the space to have future-focused conversations, knowing that we're also going to be able to talk about the urgent things. So really having two separate meetings on a daily basis has been really critical for us.
Very cool. Playing offense and defense. So you're clear what's the problem we're solving right now. Well, this has been a terrific conversation in thinking about revenue and expense and net revenue, but really in a transformational way. And I appreciate you helping to frame the conversation for us and for all the good work you're doing out there.
Well, thanks, Rick, for inviting me and thinking of me and letting me share a little time with you.
This week's assignment is to think about what's an area of core operations. Maria has been inviting us into the doability of unpacking the academic portfolio, administrative structures, right? Core operations. How do we make learning happen? So what's an area at your institution that you really haven't gone deep into? How might you do that? Who would you partner with to get that done? We'd love to hear from you on that. You can send us your thoughts at info@rpkgroup.com. So I want to thank you all for joining us in this session of the Strategic Finance Studio, brought to you in collaboration with the American Council on Education. Wherever you're listening or watching from, please stay safe and healthy in the present moment as you care for your students, for your faculty, for your staff. Higher education needs you. We'll talk to you soon, everybody.